The other night, I was speaking about the first and second noble truths of the Buddha's teachings. That is the truth of dukkha, which is sometimes translated as suffering, but really more generally means the essentially unsatisfying nature of impermanent conditioned phenomena. And the second noble truth, which is the cause of dukkha, and that is that deeply conditioned, habituated pattern in all of our minds of craving. So tonight I'd like to speak about the third noble truth, which is the end of dukkha. And the Buddha spoke of this very directly. These are his words. And this, bhikkhus, is the noble truth of the cessation of dukkha, the fading away without remainder, the cessation, the renunciation, the relinquishment, and letting go of craving. So it's pretty clear. The end of dukkha, let go of craving. Very simple. It's a very unambiguous statement of what frees the mind from suffering. But as we hear this, can we even imagine our minds free of craving? And just imagine what that would be like. It's more likely that we resonate with that famous prayer of St. Augustine, "Dear Lord, make me chaste, but not yet." I think probably we can relate more to this third noble truth like that. Let me come to the end of craving, but not quite now. A few years ago, I was on retreat and I was reflecting on this teaching of the third noble truth. And the verse the Buddha is said to have uttered, voiced, after his awakening under the Bodhi tree. You may know the first lines, "O house builder, you have now been seen, you will build no house again, this house of self, this house of ego." And then the verse ends with the lines, "Realized is the unconditioned, that which is beyond birth and death. Achieved is the end of craving." So again, the Buddha is saying very directly, this is the nature of enlightenment, of awakening. But as I was reflecting on this very profound statement, I began to understand it in a new and different way. Rather than understanding the end of craving simply as being, you know, some far-off goal in the future. Maybe sometime in the future we'll come to the end of the path and the end of craving. And rather than understanding it perhaps as some special meditative state that I might try to hold on to, I began to understand the possibility of the end of craving, this third noble truth, as the practice in each moment. That we're actually practicing the end of craving moment to moment. So this is something that we can actually do. It's not some unrealistic goal for the future. When we explore in our own experience the Buddha's declaration that the end of dukkha is coming to the end of craving, we can see for ourselves, if we're looking carefully at our own experience, we can see for ourselves how desire, how craving obscures the natural clarity, the natural ease, the natural purity of mind. And so just as an experiment, you know, in your time here and when you leave here, pay attention to to the next time, whenever it may be, you know, in a day or two or three, the next time when a desire arises. And really keep an eye out. Keep an eye out for the arising of a desire. And pay attention to what it feels like. What does it feel like when there's desire in the mind, when there's craving in the mind? And because everything is impermanent, at a certain point the desire will pass away. Notice very carefully what it feels like when the desire, the craving, has passed. So when we do this, we're experiencing the truth, even temporarily, of this third noble truth, not as a philosophic proposition. We're experiencing it through our own direct perception of what our minds are like, the dukkha of craving, and the ease of mind when the craving stops. My experience has been when I've noticed this transition of going from wanting something to not wanting, it always feels to me like the mind has been let out of the grip of something. You know, it's as if the craving or desire is just holding the mind, and then when that goes, psh, being let out of the grip of craving, of wanting, of desire. And it always feels good. Comes back to a place of ease, comes back to a place of peace. The great gift of a retreat is that you really have nothing else to do except observe this. You know, you have no other job. Your job is to watch for desires arising in the mind, feel what it's like, and then feel what it's like when the desire leaves. Did you get it? This is your job for the next few days. Tulku Urgin, who was one of the really great Tibetan Dzogchen masters within that tradition, he spoke frequently about recognizing the nature of mind, that is, the empty, aware nature, free of clinging to anything. He talked about how we need to practice recognizing the nature of mind for short moments many times. So that's a really helpful phrase. We can use that framework for practicing our understanding of the third noble truth, the end of craving, not as some far-off goal, not as some special meditative state, but rather for short moments, many times, when we see craving, we see desire, and then we see its end. We do that over and over again, and it gives us a very immediate, direct experience of the freedom of mind when the mind is free of craving, free of desire, free of wanting. We know it for ourselves. As you probably know, among the various Buddhist traditions, there are a lot of differences of vocabularies, of methods, even of basic metaphysical understandings. There are a lot of differences among the various Buddhist traditions. But there is one common understanding of what frees the mind. And it's important to focus on that common understanding if we want to understand the possibility of freedom. And that is liberation or freedom through non-clinging. This is a phrase, liberation through non-clinging, that is found many times in the Pali texts, in the suttas. And it's also found many times in the teachings of the great Tibetan and Zen masters. the same teaching, liberation through non-clinging. One of the most famous Tibetan Dzogchen masters, name was Patril Rinpoche, lived in the 19th century. And he was just a wandering vagabond, and he was greatly beloved by the common, ordinary people in Tibet. He was known as the Enlightened Vagabond. You know the word vagabond? Anyway. The wanderer, the enlightened wanderer. So I want to read, this is a teaching which Patril Rinpoche gave to himself. And it's called Advice from Me to Myself. Okay. Listen up, old bad karma Patril, you dweller in distraction. For ages now you've been beguiled, entranced, and fooled by appearances. Are you aware of that? Are you? Right this very instant, when you're under the spell of mistaken perception, you've got to watch out. Don't let yourself get carried away by this fake and empty life. Your mind is spinning around, carrying out a lot of useless projects. It's a waste. Give it up. Thinking about the 100 plans you want to accomplish with never enough time to finish them just weighs down your mind. You're completely distracted by all these projects, which never come to an end, but keep spreading out more like ripples in water. Don't be a fool. For once, just sit tight. All this Dharma practice equipment that seems so attractive, forget about it. Even though you don't know how to practice, just let go of everything. If you let go of everything, 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 that's the real point. Pretty clear. Liberation through non-clinging. So the question for us, you know, as we hear on retreat and as we live our lives in the world, how can we experience and practice non-craving? How can we put non-clinging into practice in our lives? At first, perhaps on a momentary level, and over time, more completely and fully. So we can practice and accomplish this in a variety of ways. And different Buddhist traditions highlight one way or another for accomplishing this same end, liberation through non-clinging. So a way that's familiar to us through our Vipassana practice, we can decondition, we can relinquish, we can abandon craving, through an increasingly refined awareness of the three characteristics of impermanence, of the unsatisfying nature of impermanent phenomena, of the selfless nature of phenomena. The more clearly we can see the flow of change, the more clearly we perceive impermanence moment to moment, it becomes increasingly obvious that impermanent phenomena cannot in the end be satisfying. Why? Because it doesn't last. It's so obvious. But we need to see it. I mean, we know it intellectually, but we really need to see this very directly for ourselves. And the more we see the impermanent, unsatisfying nature of things arising and passing continually, we understand on a deeper level the selfless nature of this whole unfolding process. And this perhaps is the jewel of the Buddhist teachings, the understanding that there is no one behind this process to whom it's happening. So this insight comes to us as we pay attention more and more carefully. These three characteristics of impermanence, the unsatisfactoriness, selflessness, it's what I described the other night, the Buddha called the drawbacks or the downside of experience. But happily, there is an upside to the downside. It's precisely because changing phenomena are unsatisfying in the end. It's because we see that we're motivated to awaken to a more genuine peace. And the Buddha pointed to this very directly. He said, if there were no drawbacks, if there were no dangers in the world, beings would not become disenchanted with the world. But because there are these drawbacks, beings become disenchanted by it. Okay, so right here, I think we should pause and really watch and look at your own mind to see how you feel when you hear these words of danger, drawback, disenchantment.
What's disenchantment?
Disenchantment. This is an important word to know, so everybody on disenchantment. Okay, so when we hear these words, how do we feel? Do we feel gloomy? You know, disenchantment and drawbacks and dangers. Do we feel gloomy? Do we feel fearful? Or by opening to seeing things more fully, more completely, do we have a sense of greater openness, sense of relief? It's very helpful to understand the word disenchantment, because the Buddha used it often, this quality of becoming disenchanted. He used it often and said this quality is the forerunner, the precursor, the beginning of awakening. So it's a very important idea. What does disenchantment mean? It means waking up from the spell of enchantment. You know, in fairy tales, you know, often, you know, the wicked witch puts somebody under a spell and they're asleep or something. And then, you know, the prince or the princess comes along and gives them a kiss and they wake up from this enchantment. They become disenchanted. This is what we're doing. We're waking up from the enchantment of ignorance. And that's why this is such an important idea to understand. And I had a very interesting experience of this in a very simple way on a recent retreat. You know, I love being on retreat because it's just this chance to play with one's experience and one's mind and to just explore and actually investigate all these words that we read, you know, from the Buddha and other great beings. It's one thing to read them, but it's quite another thing to actually apply them and see, well, what does this mean in my life? You know, and how does this apply in my own mind? And so lots of things get discovered when we have that interest. So are you familiar with the experience of waking up in the morning? You know, maybe the alarm goes off, you just wake up naturally. And then maybe a fragment of a thought captures the mind and you drift back into a dream for a moment or two. And then maybe you wake up again, and this might happen once or twice. Have you had that kind of experience? It's common. So on this retreat, I was doing walking meditation, and I began to notice more clearly, just in a slightly different way, all of the very light background thoughts and images that were in my mind. It was like a thin layer of thoughts, of images, fragments of stories. And as I became more aware of them, it was so interesting to see, even though they were very light and hardly noticed, they were really the ongoing creation of the world I was inhabiting. That was the creation of my mental world. And what was also very interesting was that almost all of these thoughts and images, very light, like this very thin layer, I was, you know, doing the walking meditation, so that was predominant, but this stuff was there. Almost all of them were self-referential. You know, memories, plans, what I liked, what I didn't like, judgments, comments. So then what was so surprising to me was seeing that slipping in and out of these background thoughts was exactly the same experience of going back into that dream state after waking in the morning. You know, you wake up, but then you just slip back into a dream for a few moments, and you wake up, slip back into a dream. The same thing was happening as I was doing the walking meditation. I was slipping in and out of these mind-created worlds. And so the phrase came to my mind, I'm dreaming myself into existence. And I said, that's what I'm doing. By falling into the dream of these thoughts, which were, you know, mostly self-referential, I was just dreaming myself into existence. And so that phrase became like a little mantra for me throughout the day. You know, and I would repeat it to myself. Joseph, dreaming myself into existence. And it became a useful reminder both to pay more attention, you know, to that slipping in and out of those background thoughts and images and memories. And it became an inspiration to really try to stay awake, not to fall into the dream. I mentioned a little bit the other night the importance of seeing the impermanent nature of thought, you know, and what a powerful conditioning force thought is in our lives. You know, when we're not aware of thoughts, they have so much power. They just condition our lives, condition our relationships, condition our activities. And yet when we are aware of them, we see how empty they are. They're just words in the mind. They're words in the mind appearing and disappearing in this open sky of awareness. In one discourse of the Buddha, Ananda, who was the Buddha's cousin and also attendant throughout his life, and very devotional, Ananda was this, you know, wonderfully devotional, heartful person. He was recounting to the Buddha all the marvelous qualities of the Buddha. So he had this long list, you know, of the marvelous qualities. And then the Buddha said something very interesting. He said, Ananda, this too should be remembered as one of the marvelous qualities. Namely, that the Tathagata, which is how he referred to himself, that the Tathagata is aware of thoughts as they arise, as they abide, and pass away. Remember this too as one of the wonderful qualities, marvelous qualities of the Buddha. Well, that's something. And it's particularly something because we can do that. We can actually share in this wonderful quality of the Buddha. We can be aware of thoughts arising, abiding, and passing away. So don't underestimate the importance of this. There are endless opportunities in the course of the day to practice this. Because thoughts, as you well know, arise very frequently. But how much attention do we give to them? Are we really seeing that being aware of thought arising, abiding, and passing away is of essential importance? It really becomes a vehicle for awakening. So we don't want to underestimate this part of our practice. As we watch, as our mindfulness gets stronger, we begin to experience impermanence on increasingly refined levels. We begin to see the arising and passing away, not only of thoughts, but of everything, sensations of the breath and different feelings and sounds. Even in hearing the bell, we can say, oh, I hear a sound. If we're really paying attention, how many nuances, how many different vibrations can we hear? Things are arising and passing so quickly. And as our minds get quieter, we begin to experience that refinement of the perception of change in all levels of our experience. And at first, as our minds settle into this awareness, it's very exhilarating. I mean, it's very exciting. Like the whole idea of the solidity of ourselves begins to break apart, and we're just seeing the arising and passing of thoughts and feelings and emotions and sensations. It's like a whole new world opens up. And at this time, a lot of the factors of awakening are beginning to be developed, and the mind can become shining, become like crystal glass. You know, the mind is so clear and so shining and so precise in its awareness. And very often when people come to this place in practice, they have the sense no one else has ever experienced this before. You know, it's so extraordinary. So this state is called pseudo-nirvana. And at this point of pseudo-nirvana, it's helpful to get some guidance. So that instead of just getting attached to this wonderful space, you know, somebody's around to actually guide us and show us, okay, what is the path, what is not the path. And what's interesting here is that all of the factors of awakening, enlightenment, that are strong at this point, at this stage, they're called corruptions of insight. Not because they're bad in themselves, but because of the tendency to become attached to them. So it takes a lot of care. We need, you know, as our practice deepens, this is a place that care is needed. So we go on. We continue with our mindfulness, paying attention to these wonderful states, and things change. And it actually goes through some phases that are very difficult, where we see the continual dissolution of phenomena. You know, just things are disappearing. There's no place to take a stand. It's like we're trying to stand on a slippery slope, you know, and there's no security any place. Both consciousness and the object are just falling away. And at this time, there can be a lot of distress. There can be fear, there can be anxiety. But this is all part of the development of practice. Even though it doesn't feel good, it's actually deepening practice. So again, if we get the proper guidance and understanding, we just stay mindful of this, and we come to a place of tremendous ease in the practice. It's called, Saito Pandita has called it, the perfection of Vipassana, of the stages of insight, which is just a place of great, profound equanimity. Everything becomes extremely easeful. The practice is just going on by itself. In this place of equanimity, craving, desire, that tanha, is greatly diminished. And at this place, there's a natural fading away of pleasant feeling, and neutral feeling becomes more predominant. And what's interesting is that at this stage, neutral feeling becomes more enjoyable than pleasant feeling, because it's more refined. Pleasurable feeling feels gross in comparison to the neutral feeling. So that's an interesting place, which again helps to weaken that force of craving for pleasant feeling, because our mind has become even more refined. At this place in practice, the mind is just in a place of equanimity. It's imperturbable. It's not shaking. It's not going towards anything. It's not pushing anything away. And sometimes here, all the objects disappear at times, and all that's left is consciousness. All that's left is knowing. We're not knowing anything, but we're aware of the knowing. So it's a very pure, refined state. But again, a lot of care is needed, because it's very easy to become attached to this level of purity. We become identified with this consciousness. We become identified with awareness. It becomes very easy to make a home of awareness and to have a sense of self settle right into that home. So, care is needed here. The question then arises, how can we cut through this identification even with knowing? How do we cut through the identification with awareness? Now, different traditions have different methods for doing this. In the Mahasi Sayadaw method, which is one of the traditions of Vipassana that we practice, he describes it this way. He said, at times the number of different objects may shrink to one or two, or all may even disappear. However, at this time, the knowing consciousness is still present. In this very clear, open space of the sky, there remains only one very clear, blissful consciousness, which is very clear beyond comparison and very blissful. Yogis tend to delight in this clear, blissful consciousness. This is known as Dhamma Raga, lust for the Dhamma. At this time, this knowing, this very clear, blissful consciousness simply has to be noted as knowing, knowing, knowing. We need to make that mind itself the object of mindfulness. Otherwise, we become identified with it. So this is one way of cutting through identification with awareness. In some Tibetan and Zen traditions, they cut through identification with knowing by looking for the mind itself. Okay, so when we look for the mind, can we find it? Is there anything to see? Is there anything to taste? Is there anything to touch? So again, we'll go back to the bell. And as I ring the bell and you hear the sound, see if you can find what is knowing the sound. Okay? Exactly. The sound is being known. Right? The sound is being heard. But can we find what is knowing the sound? So this is the great mystery of awareness, the great mystery of consciousness. When we look to see what it is that's knowing, there's nothing to find. And yet the knowing is there. So Tulku Urgin, he described it this way. He said, when you look for the knowing, for the awareness, and can't find it, the not finding is the finding. That becomes the understanding of the empty, aware nature of mind. It's aware. It's knowing, but there's nothing to find. So this is really interesting. I mean, I love doing this in the walking meditation. You know, so just walking and the sensations are being known. Right? It's very simple. You're moving and the sensations are being known. Known by what? Okay, so this is worth exploring. Because for the most part, and in the deepest place, what we most identify with is the knowing, is the awareness. Even when we see thoughts and sensations and the breath and as coming and going, we create a sense of self in identification with the one who's knowing it all. Freedom means cutting through that identification. So we look for the mind, we look for the knowing, can't be found. In experiencing that, the mind's empty nature is revealed. And there's a very famous Zen dialogue between Bodhidharma, who brought Buddhism from India to China, and the person who became his chief disciple. His name was Huayca. Now this dialogue, it has a kind of Zen, there's a kind of Zen wit to it. But it's actually, the humor is not the point. It's actually pointing to something very profound and transformative. So as you listen to it on that level. Okay. So Huayca comes to Bodhidharma and he says, please teach me, please give me the teachings. And Bodhidharma says, the teachings cannot be obtained from someone else. Huayca says, my mind is distressed. My mind is suffering. Please pacify it with your teaching. So Bodhidharma says, present me your mind and I will pacify it. Huayca, I've searched for my mind everywhere, but I can't find it. Bodhidharma, there, I've already pacified it. You know? Yeah. This is very profound, and I have used this dialogue in my own practice many times, and not only on retreat, just in my life, as I'm going about, and if my mind is disturbed a little bit or whatever, you know, there's something going on, I've condensed the whole dialogue because I'm very familiar with it, just into the phrase, already pacified. You know, and it just drops the mind back into that recognition of the unfindability of the mind, its empty nature. In its empty nature, it is already pacified. There's nothing more to do. And so it's an immediate coming to a place of peace, coming to an end of craving. So there are a lot of different methods, you know, and the different Buddhist traditions just have developed one or more ways of practicing this. So again, in one of my last retreats, retreats are great for stories, you know, because it's like that's where we learn things. So this was particularly useful, but there's an English word, I'm not sure you're going to, we'll have to explain the English word, you may not know it. So on this one retreat, I was just investigating, you know, all of this about the nature of the mind and letting go. And one particular teaching of the Buddha came to my mind where he said, whatever is not yours, abandon it. Let go of it. When you have let go of it, what's not yours, when you have abandoned it, that will be for your happiness and welfare. Okay? Let go of that which doesn't belong to you. Let go of that which is not yours. Okay, so what is not ours? Everything. Nothing is ours. Right? And whether you think of it in terms of the five aggregates or the sense bases, or it's all just impersonal, impermanent, selfless phenomena. So abandon that which is not yours. Let go of not yours. Go of everything. So how to do that? How to let go of that which isn't ours? So we've already discussed we can do it through seeing impermanence. And the more clearly we see it, we let go. We can do it by looking for the mind and not finding it. Already pacified, let go. But in this particular retreat, another teaching came to mind, which was another approach to letting go of what is not ours. And this is from the Dhammapada, and it's, this teaching again could be enough to enlighten us if we heard it in the right way. Where it says, let go of the past, let go of the future, let go of the present, and cross over to the further shore. Okay, so letting go of the past, letting go of the future, we can kind of understand what that means. Let go of the present. How do we let go of the present? What does that mean? So I just started experimenting. Okay, I was doing, again, walking meditation, letting go of the present. And when that phrase would come to mind, let go of the present, I could feel kind of like a dropping back, you know, from a looking at the present, a dropping back from observing the present, a dropping back from fixation on the present. And it's kind of interesting because so much of our teaching, be in the present moment, stay in the present moment, here the Buddha is saying, let go of the present. Right? So it's a different move. So it's not this, it's this. It's really that dropping back, letting go. And so when I felt my mind let go in that way, not holding on even to the present, I called that experience channel zero. Our mind is like a TV with lots of channels. You know, there's channel metta, there's channel dukkha, there's channel concentration, there's channel this, channel that. Well, this is channel zero. And I'm just dropping back into that open, empty, aware nature in which everything is arising, but there's no fixation even on the present. Do you have a sense of it's very powerful. And so in that retreat, I started using that phrase as a little mantra. I would just be walking or sitting of channel zero. And just the phrase would remind me to let go, to unfixate on the present moment, which is another way of saying let go of craving. Because there can be a craving for the present moment, which we often don't see. And then another phrase came to mind, and this is the word, I don't know if you'll know. Do you know the English term shoplifting?
Of course.
Okay. 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 Shoplifting. If you go to a store and basically you take something that doesn't belong to you. Right? So this is shoplifting. So in practicing this, you know, abandon that which doesn't belong to you. Great. Let go of the present. Great. Drop back into channel zero. Fine. Then I reminded myself, Joseph, don't shoplift. Don't pick something up again that doesn't belong to me. And so my practice just became this process. Channel zero, don't shoplift. And of course, the shoplifting happens many times, you know, and it's kind of interesting to see how often, even when we do drop back, even when we do let go of the present, how very quickly the mind will again reach for something or hold for something. But we're learning. You know, if we're paying attention to this process, we're seeing the truth of the cause of dukkha, which is craving, and the truth of the end of dukkha, which is the letting go. We're actually making this part of our practice. Okay, so as we practice in any one of these methods or any combination of these methods, in one way or another, the factors of enlightenment, of mindfulness and concentration, and energy investigation, calm, in one way or another, they all mature, they ripen, they come into balance, and they come to a place where there are just no wanting, no yearning, no craving for anything. This is Ajahn Jamnian, who's a great time master. He said this: at some point, the mind becomes so clear and balanced that whatever arises is seen and left untouched with no interference. One ceases to focus on any particular content, and all is seen as simply mind and matter, an empty process arising and passing away of its own, a perfect balance of mind with no reactions. There is no longer any doing. And so that's where our practice is heading, to that place of perfect balance. Out of that place, there comes a time when the flow of consciousness, conditioned by changing objects, suddenly stops, and the mind opens to what is called the unconditioned, or the unborn. And in Pali, the terms for this are Magapala, which is translated as path and fruition moments. And the path moment, this stopping of the flow of conditioned consciousness, the path moment happens just once for each stage of the four stages of enlightenment, and it has the power to uproot certain defilements, unwholesome states from the mind, so they never arise again. They're not just temporarily suppressed. This power of the path moment has the power to uproot these defilements. And for this reason, the Buddha described Nibbana in this way. He said, and what, bhikkhus, is the unconditioned? The destruction of lust, the destruction of hatred, the destruction of delusion. This is called the unconditioned. So the reason I'm emphasizing this right now is that I think it becomes a very useful reference point for assessing our own practice. Now, in the course, many of you are very experienced, and in the course of a life of Dharma practice, we have many kinds of experiences. The real test of our Dharma practice is whether the defilements, the unwholesome states, are weakened, and perhaps at some point uprooted, or not. We can have all sorts of fantastic experiences, and if the defilements are not weakened, if the greed, hatred, and delusion is as strong as ever, then the practice is not quite going in the right way. That is the measure of our practice. And we can use the mirror of mindfulness to look into our own minds. After 5 years, after 10 years, after 15 years, is there less greed? Is there less hatred, less anger? Is there less delusion? Or not? You know, so we can take a very honest look at our own minds, at our own practice. When the Buddha speaks of the end of dukkha, he's not speaking of simply being in a good mood. You know, he's speaking about this purification of consciousness, where these defilements have been purified, where we see through the illusion of self. Given that there are so many different Buddhist traditions, even within Theravada, it's not surprising that the different traditions describe the unconditioned, describe Nibbana in different ways. You know, and so sometimes that can be confusing, because the Thais talk about it this way, and the Burmese talk about it this way, and the Tibetans talk about it this way. So one of the common ways it's talked about, as I mentioned, is the cessation of conditioned consciousness, which is going beyond even awareness. But the Thai forest tradition, they use very different language. Ajahn Mahabhu, who is one of the great Thai forest masters, he speaks of it as the mind released. So this, he says, in these teachings, when the defilements disappear through mindfulness and wisdom, then the true mind, or the mind released, appears to its true extent. All that remains is simple awareness, utterly pure. This awareness has no reference point or center, cannot be located. It is unsupported, unconditioned, unconstructed. It is called the ultimate ease. So these two different descriptions for quite a while drove me crazy. And I don't know if any of you kind of seen my book One Dharma, but it was really trying to reconcile these two differences. You know, is Nibbana the cessation of consciousness? Is Nibbana this pure awareness? And the resolution for me was in seeing all of these different descriptions not as metaphysical statements of truth, it's this or it's that, but as skillful means for not clinging. Whichever description you like, if it helps free the mind from clinging, it's serving the purpose. But a lot of care is needed, because we can confuse very refined states of mind for what Ajahn Mahabhu called the ultimate ease. And he's one of the few masters I know who actually described the moments of his awakening to full enlightenment. Most don't really talk about it. So I want to read what he said, because his description of what happened, first, it is very powerful, but it points to the care that's needed as our mind approaches these refined states. He said, once when I went to practice at this temple, the problem of unawareness, of ignorance, had me bewildered for some time. At that stage, the mind was so radiant that I came to marvel at its radiance. Everything of every sort which could make me marvel seemed to have gathered there in the mind, to the point where I began to marvel at myself. Why is it that my mind is so marvelous? Looking at the body, I couldn't see it at all. It was all space, empty. The mind was radiant, in full force. This radiance is the ultimate counterfeit. Do you know counterfeit? Fake, right. It's, this radiance is the ultimate counterfeit, falseness. And at that moment, it's the most conspicuous or obvious point. You hardly want to touch it, the radiance, because you love it and you cherish it more than anything else. In the entire body, there is nothing more outstanding than this radiance, which is why you are amazed at it, love it, cherish it, dawdle over it, want nothing to touch it. But it's the enemy king, unawareness. So this is quite an amazing statement. But luckily, as soon as I began to marvel at myself to the point of exclaiming deludedly, with delusion in the heart, without being conscious of it, why has my mind come so far? At that moment, a statement of Dharma spontaneously appeared. This, too, I hadn't anticipated. It suddenly appeared as if someone were speaking in the heart, although there was no one there speaking. It simply appeared as a statement. If there is a point or a center of the knower anywhere, that is an agent of birth. That's what it said. So in this radiance of awareness, if there's a point or a center of the knower anywhere, if there's any identification with this awareness, then we are staying on this cycle of samsara, of birth and death. So this is the clarity that we need. You know, even as we come even to lesser stages of insight and awareness, always to be looking to deconstruct the places of our identification. What are we identifying with as being I or mine or self? However each of our practice unfolds, and all of our practice unfolds in ways unique to us. We all have our own particular conditioning, our own particular way, path of practice. But we're all developing in our practice the factors of awakening and an understanding of the Four Noble Truths. And as this happens, our minds increasingly incline to the highest peace, to freedom, to the end of dukkha, to the Third Noble Truth. I just want to close with a few lines from T.S. Eliot, from The Wasteland, which to me just kind of capture the essence of this path of freedom. He said, a condition of complete simplicity, costing not less than everything. And all shall be well, all manner of things shall be well. So this is our practice, coming to this place, condition of complete simplicity, costing not less than everything. Channel zero. And all shall be well, all manner of things shall be well. So let's sit for just a few moments and don't shoplift. Letting go of the past, letting go of the future, letting go of the present.